Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that everything, simply everything you could possibly think of, has its own history, like mushrooms, pestilence and porridge.
Oh, Sam, there's nothing like porridge on an autumnal morning. In fact,
with a sprinkling of pestilence.
with foraged blackberries, which was exactly what I had for breakfast this morning. Or stains, drains and rains, pains, mains and lanes.
Lanes is
I love
great.
The idea of going down memory lane. That is, after all, what we professional historians do, but we digress monstrously as ever, because we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, who knew, Sam, that the history of mountains, is all about freedom, prejudice, vendetta, elephants, the New Deal in America, female travel writers, and the absence of history. Well, if you didn't know that it was all about that, you should listen to last week's podcast episode, which was on the very history of mountains, or that the history of feet is all about ancient Rome, Neolithic discoveries, the abominable snowman, disguise, espionage, and the very quest for the past. I think that links us back to our lanes, doesn't it? Feet, wandering lanes, quest for the truth.
Yeah, I went for a cycle ride in mid-Devon the other day with a friend of mine, and I was kind of dumbstruck at the amount of tiny, tiny lanes they are, and the huge effort it must have taken to actually tarmac those lanes. I realised I knew nothing about it at all, about the whether there is a history, I'm sure there is, of the actual doing so and the experience of actually being out in the rural countryside tarmacking lanes. It's something I'd like to look into. I think it's fascinating.
Now there is a challenge for us, Sam. That is probably one of the most difficult things you've set us, other than a tree that bent over.
That's true.
So that we had to do the history of the lean. this is extraordinary. Yeah, I love Devon. I love those winding lanes. What about the history of accidents on those lanes? Rarely hear about accidents, but you know, they're very narrow and windy and twisty, and you can barely see where you're going. So maybe we should do the history of lanes.
Yeah, let's do the history of lanes coming up. I think that would be good.
Excellent.
Now,
excellent.
Let me introduce who I'm talking to. You're probably all wondering who he is. You've probably got no idea at all. Well, let me say,
shame on you.
If history was a condemned queen, this man would be the headsman sharpening his mighty axe of research, ready to swing with the true arc of intellectual curiosity to expose the gristle, meat and nerves of the spinal cord of the past. It is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. I imagine we're going down the same rabbit warren of heads today. From that description. So the man not sitting opposite me, because he's across town, very safe in a little tent in the middle of his house, a recording tent in the middle of his house, because we are social distancing in these grim old days. Well, let's just say, if he were a historical head, He'd only be the highest, most important head in the entirety of the historical world. A modern-day Leopold von Ranke, a modern-day Thucydides. So elevated is he, is his historical grey matter. Yes, you've guessed it. It's the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Thank you.
It's a case of one-upmanship with these at the moment, isn't it?
It's quite fun. I'm enjoying it. I don't know what we're going to do with lanes. I'll have to work on that one already.
No.
Right, we're doing heads.
We are.
Whose idea was
that? This was inspired, would you believe, by the opening of a fantastic museum across from my office at the University of Plymouth. It's a wonderful, newly refurbished, newly redesigned, multi-million pound extravaganza of a museum called The Box in Plymouth. And it is incredible. And they've been working on this for the last few years. They've had all sorts of funding come in. The City Museum has been developed. The library has been moved out. But all of the archives around the city of Plymouth have all come into this one central building. And it is fantastic. And it's called The Box because they have quite literally built an archive in the sky. If you look at it, just Google it. There are pictures all over the place at the moment. But it is amazing. They've got this sort of glass-fronted box that has been built at the top of the building to house all of the archives of the Southwest Record Centre. Record office. Absolutely brilliant. The university's a partner, and I was at an opening of the Fulston Room, which is the university's seminar room there, which is named after the leading Plymouth architect of the early 1800s, John Fulston. And when I walked into this space, I was absolutely speechless. As you know, any of you who listen to this podcast or know me as an individual, you'll know what a rare thing that is. It's only happened to me twice in the last week.
In your life.
Which is in my life. Not only did I find my new office, which is the Cottonian collection there. The Cottonian collection is this amazing collection that belongs to William Cotton of Ivybridge, who collected all sorts of paintings and prints and old masters and books and manuscripts and furniture from about 1853 to 1862. And they are all housed in that museum. And let me just say, the Cottonian Collection Room makes the Bodleian Library, the new reading room at the Bodleian Library, or the British Library Rare Books Room, feel like a porter cabin. It is so plush. So I see myself in there, working away.
Yeah.
They've got brilliant things. They've got a map. They've got an interactive map that somebody demonstrated for me, where you can basically take all the historic maps of Plymouth, choose what you want, and then overlay them all over each other.
Ooh,
and look
that
at the development of the city. But what made me even more speechless, and this was what led to the inspiration for this podcast, is that when you walk into the main entrance of the atrium, you see hanging there 14 Victorian Royal Naval figureheads suspended from the sky. And these things weigh several tons. And they've already won a prize for the refurbishment and curation of these, the conservation of them. They've already won a prize for that. But they are incredible. And you are greeted by the biggest figurehead, which is King Billy, which was carved in Plymouth in 1832.
Has he got good facial hair?
Royal William. It has fantastic... Sam, you will absolutely love this. 13 of these are on loan from the National Museum of the Royal Navy. They're all suspended from the ceiling, and they are absolutely, absolutely amazing. The figureheads also all have names. There's Aurora, who's about a 2.5 tall female bust, made in 1855, and the ship was served in Canada. There's a Basilisk, there's a Cadmus, Calcutta, Calliope, Centaur, Defiance, Minerva, a mystery figurehead, all in white based on the Greek goddess of wisdom. Royal William himself, King Billy, made in 1833, as I said, which is a figurehead of William the Fourth, dressed in all his sort of ceremonial robes and looking very, very bearded. There's a Sphinx, Sibyl, Tamar, Topaz, and even Windsor Castle, a large figurehead of Queen Victoria measuring over 4 metres tall. So there we are, starter for 10. Over to you, because I guess you know quite a lot about ships' figureheads, Sam.
Well, I do, actually. And so I've seen many of these in the Devonport Royal Naval Museum, which is currently closed, but it's a wonderful collection and it's worth going to see. I'm fascinated by ships' figureheads primarily because I think there's much more work that can be done on them. One of the interesting things they have been looking at with this collection is the conservation is peeling back the layers of paint to see how they were painted before and whether this painting has happened over many generations since they were actually used on the ships, or whether it's reflecting their original appearance. And some fairly important work's been done on this recently, and it's concluded that actually there were many, many more plain white figureheads than painted, and that actually many of them may have been painted in an afterlife. You've got to think about how these figureheads came into the collections, which is fascinating, where they come from. So primarily they come from sheds and store areas in Plymouth, in Portsmouth and in Chatham, the three major naval dockyards. What happens is a ship would then be broken up when it comes to the end of its life, but the ship breakers, the people working on the ship, were unwilling, unhappy to get rid of an image which was so clearly linked with the spirit of the ship, which raises all sorts of really interesting questions about why they came about in the first place and actually what they did mean to the crew and how that changed. So to understand figureheads, you've got to realise that the early figureheads were all lions, all of them. Some were crowned, some weren't crowned, but they were all lions and they weren't painted. They were a fairly kind of dull, varnishy colour. And then that changed very specific at a very specific time in 1727 when the Admiralty permitted the use of figureheads instead of lions, which allowed all sorts of interesting figures, some humans, some beasts, some birds, to be created. And they were all somehow related to the name of the ship. So from 1727, you have these extraordinary figureheads that start to be placed on the ships. But then that changes again in about 1860, when they start making ships out of iron. So you've got ships like the Warrior, a merchant version would be the SS Great Britain, and then thereafter they're making ships out of steel. And the world's moved on, and carved timber doesn't have a place on a ship anymore. Exactly why, I think, is a question that really needs answering, because the standard definition at the moment is that ships were made out of iron, therefore there was no place for a carved figurehead. However, the argument for them existing in the first place is that they were put there because they somehow embraced the spirit of the ship, and there was a need to instill an esprit de corps from the captain to the crew. But surely, this is where I say surely, that need for an esprit de corps, that need to capture the spirit of the ship, to give the crew an identity, the ship an identity, must have carried on. So how come they suddenly stopped producing figureheads when they certainly could? It was not beyond the realms of them to be able to do it. So I think that's very interesting indeed, and I think it needs to be explained more. One of the general points I wanted to make is that when you look at these figureheads, it's figureheads from a very specific period of time. It's about 1727 to 1860, so not before that, not in the 17th century. Not in the 16th century, Tudor ships didn't have figureheads. And going back, medieval period, they didn't. Well, not like this. Anyway, some Viking ships had curious sea monsters. And then thereafter, after 1860, they didn't. So it's an absolute specific period in time when Britain's establishing an empire, when all sorts of interesting things are happening. And I'm sure that there are more culturally informed explanations out there if any historian would like to look into it. So not only why these things are fantastic to look into, and I might just stop this, James, and do a PhD in figureheads. Because you've
I
got,
think you should.
Not only have you got the collection themselves, you've got the material culture, you've got drawings of the figureheads made by shipwrights, but those who specifically were skilled at art and representing figures. They're beautiful, and they're at the National Archives, and you can see them, and they're absolutely amazing. And they're proposals for figureheads which were accepted and proposals for figureheads that were rejected, which is also interesting. So who is it who's deciding what is accepted, what's permissible to go on the front of a British warship, and what isn't? Now, on top of this, there's an amazing private collection. James, you'd like this with your collections head on.
Yes.
There are 60 black and white designs, and they are found recently in a private house in Tasmania. And what happens here, it's known as the Dickerson collection. You've got three members of the Dickerson family. They were responsible for carving the figureheads at Plymouth and Devonport for, you know, for years. And what happened is that they had copies, or they retained the originals of the drawings that were actually approved by the Surveyor of the Navy. And then they kept their own kind of folio of drawings, and they carted them off to Tasmania when the family moved to Tasmania. So there's this amazing, possibly a wild archive, James. It may be uncatalogued. You may not know what's in it. But there's a private collection in Tasmania, which I'm desperate to get my hands on. Not only this, but there are figureheads from the Russian Navy, the Swedish Navy, the French Navy, the Spanish Navy, the Portuguese Navy, the American Navy. I could carry on going, and they're all different. And exactly why is absolutely fascinating. Race is important in this. There are images of Native Americans, there are images of Africans, there are images of people from India, all specifically, very clearly and carefully created, drawn, and then created in three dimensions. Exactly how, exactly why, and exactly what that meant to the members of the crew is not only a PhD project in waiting, it's a book, and a TV documentary, and a feature-length blockbusting film, I should think. There we go, Jess.
I think you've got the next decade pretty well sorted out there, Sam.
Anyway, go to the box. Even better, join the University of Plymouth, and then you can study in the box. Either way, there is an amazing collection of figureheads, which is what inspired our talk here on heads. Fascinating stuff, Jess.
It certainly is. Hearing you talk about figureheads and the colours of figureheads, I was very struck when I was doing a research project at the Vasa Museum. The Vasa is this wonderful early 17th century warship. And at the front of it, there is, of course, a lion, the Vasa lion, so the Vasa royal family, the royal family of Sweden, Gustavus Adolphus, Gustav II. But on the back of it are all these carved figures. And what if you have a look at it having been dredged up, of course, it's all very dark in colour. So it's the wood is a sort of dark brown. But a team of researchers at the Vasa has basically pieced together the colour patterns. And actually, the ship wouldn't have been a boring sort of dull brown colour, but would have been a sort of riot of vibrant colours. And over the last 12 years, they have found and analysed over 1,200 microscopic fragments of colour that show, and what they've been able to do is use the analysis of that to show that 15 particular pieces of sculpture, they've been able to recreate what the exact colour of them would be. And this was the feature of a recent exhibition that they've had called The Power and the Glory, which shows what the Vasa would have looked like in full Technicolor as she went out of Stockholm Harbour, the pride of the Navy, only to sink, you know, a few hundred yards into the sea.
The general point here is that the figurehead is not the only heads on some of these ships, particularly the 17th yes. century. And if you looked at the Sovereign of the Seas or any of the other major amazing ships in the 17th century, it's when ship design was at its most elaborate. There are all sorts of other heads, a bit like If you look at the west front of Exeter Cathedral, that's what I'm thinking about there, a medieval screen. You've got, I mean, it's completely overloaded with figures, just like ships were. So I think drawing inspiration from the medieval world as well, James, where having faces and heads peering at you, gargoyles, do all.
I know. When I was an undergraduate at Oxford, I used to wander down New College Lane just simply to see the extraordinary medieval gargoyles there, or misery cords, the faces that are underneath, the carved faces that are underneath seats in medieval churches. However, I wanted to take us on a completely different way, and I wanted to talk about heads as in heads of state. And we've looked at this when we've looked at monsters before. And remember, we've done a podcast on monsters. We've written a chapter on the history of monsters in our book on the Tudors. And one of the things that we looked at there was the way in which the human body and the body politic work together to describe the political organisation of states. And so if you think about the body politic, the head of the body is the monarch, the ruler. And then the sort of, if you continue that metaphor, the arms and the eyes and the feet and all of that are all the sort of different sort of parts of the.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Body politic. But what we were interested in when looking at monsters is what happens when that body, when the head of that body is corrupted, is cankered, is monstrous. So famously, John Knox, that sort of very fiery Scottish Reformation theologian, in his book, The Trumpet Blast Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women, justified the removal of a Catholic monarch by saying that basically when the body had become corrupted, the head was female, the body was monstrous, and so could be removed. And so what this led to is a whole series of resistance theories, resistance tracts, that would basically decide what was going to happen if a monarch was tyrannical, if a monarch had a particularly an alternative religion. And you can follow this all the way through somebody like John Knox, all the way through to John Milton in his tract, The Tenure of Kings and Magistrates, which he wrote shortly after the execution of Charles I to justify the beheading of the king. And you can follow it all the way back to some of the sort of very conservative literature which talks about the ordering of society. Think here about Shakespeare's Great Chain of Being, where you have the sort of the heavens and God and then the angels, you know, in the sort of celestial sphere. Then you come down onto earth and you've got the monarchy, you've got the aristocracy, and then you sort of follow it all the way down the social hierarchy. It's when that gets corrupted that things change and you're able to come in and justify resistance. We can trace this from Calvin, you know, working on the continent, but actually working in a much more peaceful way. We can trace it through somebody like John Ponnet, another mid-Tudor writer who in his A Short Treatise of Politic Power justified the overthrow of monarchy with a surgical strike. But I think it gets its most potent sort of treatment in John Milton. Milton is a magisterial writer with such an enormous output. The full title of his tract is The Tenure of Kings and Magistrates, Proving That It Is Lawful and Hath Been Held So Through the Ages for Any Who Has the Power to Call to Account a Tyrant or Wicked King and After Due Conviction to depose and put him to death if the ordinary magistrate have neglected or denied to do it, and that they who of late so much blame deposing are men that did it themselves. And this was printed in February 1649. And remember that Charles I had only just been executed 2 weeks before. On the 30th of January 1649, he had his head chopped off outside the banqueting house in Whitehall. And what Milton is doing is, after the fact, is leaving a justification for the execution of the monarch. And he begins describing the nature of tyranny. "Hence is it that tyrants are not oft offended, nor stand much in doubt of bad men, as being all naturally servile, but in whom virtue and true worth most is eminent, them they fear in earnest, as by right their masters. Against them lies all their hatred and suspicion. Consequently, neither do bad men hate tyrants, but have been always readiest with the falsified names of loyalty, obedience, to colour over their base compliances." And he continues by talking about Parliament calling on the people to support their actions and wisdom. "Another sort there is who, coming in the course of these affairs to have their share in great actions above the form of law or custom, at least to give their voice an approbation, begin to swerve and almost shiver at the majesty and grandeur of some noble deed, as if they were newly entered into a great sin, disputing precedents, forms, and circumstances, when the commonwealth nigh perishes for want of deeds in substance done with just and faithful expedition. To these I wish better instruction and virtue equal to their calling, the former of which, that is to say, instruction, I shall endeavour, as my duty is, to bestow on them, and exhort them not to startle from the just and pious resolution of adhering with all strength and assistance to the present Parliament and army in the glorious way wherein justice and victory hath set them. When kings or rulers become blasphemers of God, oppressors and murderers of their subjects, they ought no more to be accounted kings or lawful magistrates, but as private men to be examined, accused, condemned, and punished by the laws of God. And being convicted and punished by the law, it is not man's but God's doing." And then he goes on to basically describe how the monarch being executed is fair game for these people. So there we have it, the idea of the monarch or the ruler as the head of state, and then the execution of the monarch by chopping off the head. I've been thinking a lot about heads of state and the role of heads as we observe what is happening around the world today, particularly what's happening in America. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about knowledge of the health of a ruler, and, you know, a lot of concern about the health and probity of a ruler, and wondering whether we are allowed to have that kind of insight. I mean, of course we are. Once you become a head of state, you are no longer a private individual. You are the head of the body politic, and therefore your health, whether you've tested positive for COVID or not, is quite rightly the, you know, property of the nation.
That makes me think of Henry VIII's groom of the stool investigating his urine and feces, because it was basically public property, essentially, wasn't it? It was so crucial to the not the health of the king himself, but representative of the health of the nation. And that was something that was also done in China. I should think all over the place as well.
Today. You still have that concern with the health of, say, for example, an American president, the health of the president and those routine health checks that are then made public. And in the case of the incapacity of a president, so the inability to actually discharge their duties, there are set in place a series of protocols that you go through in those circumstances to be able to replace him or her with somebody else who is of fit and sound body and mind. And able to properly discharge their duties. So there's, I mean, the health and politics is actually fascinating. There's a book for you. There's a research project. Mm.
Health, politics and lanes and figureheads.
And wooden heads.
I'm going to wrap up this portion of our episode on heads, James, because we've got so much more to do. But I wanted, I've just pinged you an email. Have a look at that.
Ah, loving that. What's that?
So here we are. It is amazing. Can you describe it? I'll tell you what it is in a minute. But the quality of it is amazing. I'll tell you what it is. It's a terracotta bust of Sir Walter Raleigh.
Oh, love it.
And it is absolutely mind-blowing. And I think one of the points we're talking about is, you know, you have these metaphors of the head of the body politic, and let's just stop and think about what a head actually looked like. And I think this is about as good as you can possibly get. It's Tudor. It was made by John Michael Riesbrach, very celebrated Flemish sculptor of the mid-18th century. And his subject here is the Tudor Walter Raleigh, and the detail of it is absolutely extraordinary. Now, you can get a certain amount from portraits, of course, and from descriptions of people, but to actually look at a three-dimensional head here is quite amazing. James, tell me about his hat.
Very rakish.
It is, isn't it?
It's very rakish. It's a brimmed hat with a feather coming out of it.
At a tremendously jaunty angle, he's got a wonderfully trimmed beard, a fabulous ruff, and also a very detailed jewelled kind of surcoat of some description. So it's just worth thinking about how you actually get close physically to appearance and heads in the past. We wrote a little bit about this in our book on the Tudors in terms of faces, just to make the point essentially that a surprising variety of people do exist in Tudor portraiture. You might just think it's all about heads of state, it's all about wealthy people, but actually there are all sorts of images. Yes, monarchs and noblemen, noble women and their children, but there are also a huge variety of images across a whole social world. And it's interesting how you actually can look at these. Some are formal paintings of the monarchy. Others are much smaller, tiny, often embedded in little lockets or private chests, boxes or drawers for personal appreciation and remembrance. So there are civic leaders, there are merchants, lawyers, clergy, actors, writers, scholars, artisans, all sorts of people out there. And it's a fascinating way of actually engaging with the past. So, yes, you've got busts like this wonderful Walter Raleigh, but of course portraits. And there's a whole world, a whole social life of the Tudor world, while we're talking about the Tudors, out there that you can engage with. So a huge variety of different sources, which can help you get close to the past. It's also reminded me about broadside ballads from the Tudor period and how they particularly deal with ageing. And they give you a sense of what it was like being and getting old in the past, particularly in how it affected your face. Here, there's a wonderful thing here. They write of the wrinkles in my brow, the furrows in my face. Say the limping age must lodge him now where you the must give him place. I love that. Absolutely
love
brilliant.
It. I love the example of Raleigh's head as well. It makes me think of the time we went to that wonderful church in Stratford-upon-Avon to do our show, the Holy Trinity Church.
Yep.
And there was the funerary monument of William Shakespeare there.
Yes, that's right. Because it's his head.
In the chancel, yes.
His head and bust kind of peering out in a slightly weird way.
Extraordinary. I've just, and it connects to a book I've just read, Maggie O'Farrell's Hamnet, which is an extraordinary book. This is a slight aside, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's just won a major prize and absolutely brilliant. And my book group read it recently. A brilliant choice. And it is about, it's a fictional account of Shakespeare's wife, Anne Hathaway, who's named Agnes in this, and the impact of the death of their son, 11-year-old Hamnet, from the plague. But it made me reflect on how historians read historical fiction. And I found that actually I didn't enjoy it as much as I wanted to, because this is a book not only about early modern women, it had a lot on gloves, it had a lot on letters and the postal system. And frankly, I'm a professor in that. And I was constantly going, Daybell, stop paying attention to that. Just enjoy the beautiful prose and the wonderful ideas and the creativity. And actually, I felt that I was quite handicapped being a professor of Tudor gender and letters and gloves. And I was sort of taken down those alleyways and reading it as an empiricist when I didn't want to. I wanted to read it purely for, you know, the lovely, sumptuous detail. But it's a wonderful book. You should all go out and read Hamnet.
Mm.
It is in hardback, but it's worth the investment.
Worth the investment. I like that. Yes. I hope you enjoyed that, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to come back with more on Heads, because, as ever, James and I have only just begun.
What have you got coming up, Sam? I'm going to talk a lot about decapitation.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about decapitation as well. I'm also going to talk about shrunken heads.
I'm going to talk about Oliver Cromwell's head the journey of his head.
I'm going to talk a little bit about Washington Irving.
Excellent.
Yeah,
it's love
all,
it.
All coming your way, guys. Do please follow me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And please do check out my forthcoming new podcast. I'm doing one dedicated to maritime and naval history, which is being sponsored by the Society for Nautical Research. It's going to be called The Mariner's Mirror. And by the time this episode is out, there may well be a trailer for you guys to find.
And you can follow me on at James Daybell. And you can follow the podcast on at Unexpected Pod.
Do please check out everything we've done, all the wonderful stuff we've done, we're very proud of, on historiesoftheunexpected.com. And if you'd like to support the podcast, we'd be hugely grateful. You can either just leave a review on iTunes, that really helps. Or if you're feeling generous, then we're on patreon.com/historiesoftheunexpected. And that would help keep this podcast going. It'd be much, much appreciated. Thank you all very much, so much for listening, guys. And we'll be with you again soon.
We will, guys. And just remember, it is only 10 weeks till Christmas.
I love it. Love it. We want some ideas for Christmas shows, don't we?
Exactly. Exactly. I'm already keeping notes for our Christmas shows, Sam.
Christmas lanes. I think we should do lanes.
Christmas lanes, Christmas, definitely.
Yeah.
I think it is. I want to do patience next. Not as in patience as in urgency and being impatient, or the opposite of being impatient, but actually patience. So the patience view of history. I read a brilliant piece by the wonderful but late historian Roy Porter this week for a class I'm teaching on cultural history called The Patient's View of Medical History. It was just superb. So it's got me thinking about that sort of thing. So I'd love to do that.
Okay, definitely. I've been editing a diary recently for the Navy Record Society, in which a retired naval officer becomes a surgeon on transatlantic liners in his retirement. He retires from the Navy, becomes a surgeon, and then ends up treating the king.
Oh, Sam, we should do it.
Yeah.
We should make it happen.
We're absolutely right. Well, that's what's coming, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be in touch soon. Bye.
Bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.